thanks ever so much for joining us again for this week's Tech Law 10. In fact, we're recording two on the bounce because we're here together in Philadelphia. But one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is you and I have both been speaking at quite a few conferences on both sides of the pond. I've got to thank the people at AKJ Associates and the people at Portcullis Security for their excellent event at the Tower of London just last week. And by the way, now is probably a good time to mention it. We are available for bar mitzvahs, weddings, or even corporate training. And I've been doing quite a lot of that recently, that businesses want us to come and talk about e-commerce risks to them. And that's always something that we're happy to do at very reasonable rates, isn't it, Eric?
That's very true. This is Eric Sinrod, also in Philadelphia, sitting right across from Jonathan Armstrong, 2 feet from me. We're the Duane Morris attorneys bringing you this week's Tech Law 10. And yes, we are available. I go in-house and frequently will speak on issues having to do with electronic discovery, dispute resolution, cyber law risks and liabilities, you name it, the whole gamut.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned e-discovery, actually, because that's one of the things that really cropped up at this Tower of London event. People there were doing risk mapping. What are their technology risks for the future? And one of the big risks, even for UK domestic businesses, is US patent litigation. But more importantly, I think the costs of that patent litigation because of the whole e-discovery process. And you've got some good news this week for those people, have you?
Perhaps. I mean, what we know is, you know, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure a few years ago were amended to specifically contemplate electronic discovery in civil litigation, and the states have pretty much done the same thing. So on the one hand, people think that's a great thing because you can really get at all sorts of information in your discovery efforts, hopefully find the smoking gun and win your case. And it should be simple because it's all electronic and it's data which can be searched and manipulated. On the other hand, what we've really found, it's a whole nother collateral track of litigation, and it can be phenomenally burdensome, time-consuming, and expensive. And oftentimes, it can be the tail that wags the dog in litigation. If you have a dispute where the amount at issue is, let's just say, $250,000, and the discovery efforts are going to be $1 million, that kind of tells you what you need to do. You need to resolve the case not really even get to the merits. And it can also be used as a weapon, especially in the David versus Goliath type case. You know, if you have sort of the individual plaintiff, you know, suing a major company, they can ask for all kinds of discovery from the major company, but how much can you really get from the plaintiff, for example? So, you know, there have been some criticisms of this. There have been some abuses, and along comes, you know, one of the judges of the Federal Circuit here in this country, and at a recent conference, he proposed a model order to deal with electronic discovery in patent cases. And the purpose of the model order is such that federal trial courts around the country can consider this, and in their inherent powers and authority, they can actually adopt or modify and use this model order. And let me just tell you a few of the features.
Sure.
It gives you a sense of, you know, how limited electronic discovery would be if adopted. For example, metadata would not be produced absent a showing of good cause.
And metadata is that those hidden tags, if you like, on Word documents and so on that tell us who's altered the document and when and so on.
Exactly. Now, certain basic information there can be included or should be included in terms of you know, the date and time when a document was sent, the distribution list and things like that, but nothing more sophisticated than that. Let's see. That basically electronic discovery requests generally should not include email or other forms of electronic correspondence. That's in terms of the general requests. When you do email requests, they should be propounded only for specific issues. They're to be phased to occur after, you know, basic disclosures having to do with the patents, the prior art, and, you know, the core patent issues in a case. This is very important. When you're asking for emails, when you're being specific this way, you can only ask them of five custodians. That's basically only the email of five different people, and there can only be five search terms employed in terms of harvesting the emails of those five people, absent an agreement by counsel or a court order modifying it. You know, we've had cases where you can have, you know, emails produced from hundreds, maybe thousands of people. There could be multiple dozens of search terms. I had a case, it was a large case, but there were over 200 million separate electronic records produced. Plainly, if these rules were in place, there would be just a drop in the ocean of such a production. And then lastly, to try to reduce review time in advance of electronic production, the model order would say that the inadvertent production of something privileged or work product would not constitute a waiver. So what that would mean is you could produce electronic information fairly wholesale, and if it turns out there was an attorney-client communication there, you just retrieve it back, and the other side can't use it. Right. And you don't have to worry about it too much.
Yeah.
So these are pretty phenomenal suggestions.
Well, I've got a couple of questions for you. First of all, is this likely to get any traction? And secondly, given the U.S. system, is this judge signing his own retirement papers? I mean, will it be the case that the court will be so narrow in the documents that it lets people look at that plaintiffs will just move elsewhere and file in a different court?
Well, again, this is a model order, so it's up to individual courts to decide to adopt or not. I suspect we're either going to see a major gravitation in this direction or not. I think it'll take hold or not. So, for example, you know, at one point in time, early in my practice, you know, getting electronic information produced in litigation was fairly novel, and we actually had to fight. I actually established precedent in one case against the federal government, where the government had to turn over electronic information, not just paper files, and that was back in the 1980s, and that was considered revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now the expectation is relatively the opposite, but it took some, you know, movement in that direction. I believe, you know, once courts start going in this direction, if they do, there could be a real groundswell of support, and then it would happen not only in terms of traction in patent cases, but all sorts of federal cases, and then maybe also state cases, because I think there really is a generalized concern about the cost and expense of litigation, especially in this economy. But the counterpoint I do want to say before I turn it back over is that, you know, this electronic discovery, you know, can be helpful. I mean, there are times in a case where you might be going through many thousands of electronic records and you do find the smoking gun and it's right on point and it wins your case. And it is conceivable that if we drastically limit electronic discovery, you're not going to find that. Now, there's no such thing as perfection here, so what's good enough?
But to be old-fashioned, if I may throw in another first, a bit of Latin, doesn't that undermine the principle of a incumbit probatio qui dicit non qui negat, Eric? And I'm sure you know what that means.
Well, I sing it to my children every night before bedtime.
But isn't that the case, really, that instead of you having to get up there and prove your case, isn't the real criticism of US e-discovery is you only have to have 10% of a case, trawl through the emails, look hard enough, troll through enough emails, and you'll find the other 90% and make your case. And isn't that sort of really the antithesis of the justice system that you inherited from us, which says that, you know, the minute you issue proceedings, the burden is on you to prove your case. And in some respects, aren't you hearkening back to the old days? You're almost wanting to come back into the empire, at least in terms of your litigation.
The Boston Tea Party lives on, and I do love it when you speak Latin to me. Res ipsa loquitur to you, buddy, or et tu, Brute. But anyhow, I don't know. I don't think we're going back to the mothership anytime soon. I mean, I do think this is a little off from what you were saying, but, you know, one feature that we generally don't have is, you know, the loser pays the attorney's fees.
Yeah.
And that's definitely, you know, sends a chill on litigation and encourages one side to really think carefully about whether they want to even bring a lawsuit in the first place, because here you don't get attorney's fees unless authorized by statute or in by contract. You know, are we going to swing back to very, very, very limited discovery? I don't think so, but I think there will be a curbing of the phenomenal electronic discovery we're seeing now.
Yeah, and I think that would be welcomed in Europe. I mean, as I say, this is one of the big issues for corporates, I think. And it contrasts with places, you know, like France, where that would be the U.S. system is called Le Fishing Expedition by some. And in Italy, I once went to an event in Italy, and we had lawyers from the U.K., from the U.S., from Italy, a number of other jurisdictions. And there was a pretrial e-discovery request. And the Italian attorney said, said to the Italian attorney, how would you react? And he got the piece of paper and he ripped it up and he threw it in the bin. And he said, so they're going to fax you another request. I'm going to rip it up and send it again. He said, okay, they're now so mad, they're going to ring you and say you're ignoring our e-discovery requests. And he said, and I'm just going to tell them they don't apply in Italy and hang up. You know, so there it is a very, very different system. And I guess they're more in the, you bring a case, you've got to prove it, you don't get any assistance from the defendant to do that.
Well, and one trend we are seeing, and I know we're getting toward the end of our podcast here, one trend we're seeing is that even if there aren't strict limitations on the front end, there can be more cost shifting.
Right.
So that if let's say your client, you on behalf of your client, and we're at different law firms, you know, you serve fairly broad-ranging e-discovery on my client, and I'm at a different firm. If I can convince you or the judge that, frankly, we think the probative value of what you seek is far outweighed by the burden you're going to impose, yes, you can have it, but you're going to pay the freight.
Right.
And it's interesting because if you put it back on the propounding party, oftentimes they're like, well, never mind. So, you know, that's where you see what its true value really might be. But then again, on the other hand, you don't always know what the true value is going to be. I mean, in some ways, you're operating in the dark. I mean, I might want to have email production from your client across 30 different custodians and 25 different search terms. And, you know, it might be the 29th custodian and us using the 24th search term where we find that critical draft internal memo that we never would have received otherwise that has all sorts of damning admissions.
Mm.
And, you know, when, you know, in our country here, you know, even if there's the production of thousands or even millions of documents, when you actually go to trial, even in a really big case, how many trial exhibits are there really?
Yeah.
A hundred, a couple hundred, and it's only those smoking guns. And the ones that are really fantastic, you put on the screen, you have it in front of the judge and the jury as much and as often as possible during the trial, because that just colors the entire case.
Yeah. Now, that sounds good. I think it is time to wrap up. I guess I would summarize. I mean, you're defending, if you like, with all these high litigation costs, you're defending the right of American expensive speech as opposed to free speech, but you've done it very ably.
No, I'm not. I'm actually being fair and balanced, and I'm pointing out that discovery can create a burden and abuses. It can also lead to fantastic information, and there needs to be a way of dealing with this that makes practical sense. So those are my words.
Right. Now I've got it absolutely.
Yeah, there you go.
So thanks very much for listening. You can, as ever, contact us with your suggestions for future topics. If you just search our names on the internet, you should find us, or go to www.duanemorris.com, and our details are there. We're on Twitter, you're on Facebook, we're on LinkedIn. And do tune in next week when we'll have another riveting topic to talk you through.
Right, and my email is ejsinrod@duanemorris.com. And here we are, Jonathan and I, in person. And I can say we're much better looking in person than we are on the internet. So have us come and see you, and we'll give you a talk and hopefully educate you a little bit. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening.